I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Desert Isolation Discs. I'm delighted to introduce today's guest. He's a Southend boy done good who's traded working in the bingo halls at the home of the world's longest pier for West London and a lengthy career in journalism. He's been published by just about every national newspaper and currently works alongside me at The Independent and Evening Standard. His personable writing style and desire to guide people away from financial troubles has earned him not only the moniker of the People's Champion, but several awards too, although he's usually been at the bar when he's supposed to be collecting them. He's known for his Jimmy White-style waistcoats, dedication to sunglasses and cocktails, and his propensity to be spotted in the stands at Stamford Bridge. His eclectic music taste and constant desire for a chuckle mark him out as a class act. My guest is Simon Reid. Simon, it's an absolute pleasure to welcome you as a guest on Desert Isolation Discs. Your life is pretty defined by music. You know, you're obsessed with it and you've got headphones on, you know, most of the places you go. How did you approach assembling this list?
Do you know, I thought about, tunes that I like or mean a great deal to me, but I descended on ones that helped me change my appreciation of music. You know, I'll go straight in with the one I'm going to start off with is Dr. Feelgood, who, when I grew up in the 70s, they were a local band. And, you know, I hadn't seen them. They weren't the first band I saw live. The first band I saw live was called Bartley James Harvest. They were a prog band. You know, when I went to their concert, it was remarkable because it's so loud.
Yeah.
But you know, it didn't touch me at all.
Yeah.
It didn't make me feel alive or excited or that it was just this noise. You know, most of the first few gigs I went to, it was like, well, here I am going to these gigs, seeing these big bands, and you know, here's their music.
So that's
it. This is in Southend, yeah. And then I went to see Dr. Feelgood because they're a local band, and it's the first time I experienced the thrill. You know, when you can feel the music in your heart, you feel the you want to dance to it. It's not just standing there nodding your head and thinking, oh, isn't this deep? It was like this is alive, this is vibrant, this is fascinating, this is making me want to feel things, you know, and shout and dance.
Yeah.
And it's Dr. Feelgood who did it for me, and they were. They shook up the whole music industry. There would be no punk rock without Dr. Feelgood. There would have been, you know, they were just not just the music. It was the attitude. Lee Brillo, the lead singer, was a he basically looked at you and said, "I don't care what you think. This is what I'm doing." You know, he out rotten Johnny Rotten long before he did. Attitude. Walker Johnson, the guitarist, there, you know, he had manic dance. You know, looked at you again with a 1,000-yard stare. It's just so fascinating to watch and to feel part of. And so, you know, the first track was one of their first tracks they recorded, written by Wilco Johnson, called She Does It Right.
And were you dressed like them in the crowd?
No, not really. They were thin ties, black suits or white jacket. Famously, Lee Brillo had a white jacket. I was still jeans and T-shirts then. In fact, I still am now. I still haven't upgraded my...
No, you're still dressed like a teenager. Uniform. Fantastic. Let's have a listen.
We'll be right back.
Dr. Feelgood there. So Simon mentioned Southend there growing up. What was it like growing up in a seaside town?
It was fantastic. You know, my first job was making candy floss, selling candy floss to passing girls on a seafront cafe. And you know, it was great. Stand there with it, you know, it was a great chat-up line to do. I used to eat too much candy floss. I had other jobs soon after, working in a bingo hall, which was fascinating, you know, in gift shops. It was really quite exciting. I mean, it really felt... I mean, I came from, let's face it, a fairly middle-class home. Mm. Both my parents are teachers, and down the seafront, Romeo and cigarettes, all this kind of stuff. You know, yeah. it was exciting. And, you know, at that time, in the 70s, it was an exciting music scene. It wasn't just Dr. Feelgood. Mm. We had Eddie and the Hot Rods, who were brilliant. We had the Kersal Flyers, who had chart success. A whole lot of other local bands who were all good and local and fun and entertaining. Mm. You know, it really felt like... it didn't feel like it was the centre of the world by any stretch. I mean, I had to go up to London to find the real excitement. But, you know, it was...
Did you support those bands like you would a football team? Did
very much so. Very much so. You know, going up to the Hope and Anchor to see the Kersal Flyers, for instance. You know, they felt like ours. They were our bands. Feelgood, especially. On Candy Island, just outside Southend, they had Feelgood House where...
Yeah.
You know, you could always feel there's an open invitation to go there and hang out and stuff, you know. And you could often have a drink with Lee Brillo. He's just drinking the pub called The Grand in Leigh-on-Sea, part of the south end, the estuary coastline there. And you could go in and have a chat with him. I mean, he was gruff and didn't suffer fools and all that. But, you know, he wasn't like a rock star.
Yeah.
Although, you know, on stage he was snarling and all that. But, you know, they were part of our... youth, they're a part of us. It was exciting, sure.
Who were you hanging with at that point?
Who are my mates?
Yeah.
I was, you know, because I was working, particularly when I was working at the bingo hall.
Yeah.
Everyone, I was, what, 15? Everyone else was 17 or 18, left school, and had other sorts of dodgy jobs. So I was hanging with them. They were really dodgy crowd. Several of them ended up inside. You know, I can remember one, I've forgotten his name, he's done for nicking T-shirts. You know, and I can remember the court case where at Southend Crown Court, and you know, he denied nicking his T-shirts, but he was actually wearing one to the court case. You know, it was they weren't the most you know, it's a world of tattoos and fish and chips and all sorts of exciting things. You know, when you're growing up, you want some grit in your life, and there's a lot of grit there. It was great.
See where it comes from. So what's the second choice you've got for
it? Well, I've moved right along from Dr. Feelgood. I mentioned that they were the godfathers of punk, whatever it's called. It was punk music. It was my generation music. It was the first music that really felt like ours. It was music that, you know, there was no pretense. I, my whole life, really since then, I've hated things and people that take themselves too seriously. The punks didn't take themselves too seriously, though some of them did, but it was largely happy, it was rebellious, it was shouting, it was about us. And the one that kicked the whole thing off, the whole punk movement started by the Ramones, Blitzkrieg Bop. I can remember getting the picture sleeve of it. Hey Ho, Let's Go, it said on the front, Gabba Gabba Hey, which, you know, came out of that. And it just seemed that these guys were great. They didn't care. They didn't sound great. I remember taking it around to different people's houses and everyone said, this is rubbish. Yes, it is. It's brilliant, you know. And it kick-started that whole guitar bands, simple, tight, short, you know, no pretension at all.
Yeah, fantastic. That's fantastic.
Back seat.
So I'm back in the room with Mr. Simon Reed. So Simon, we're in one of your first loves, a pub. Another one of your great loves is, of course, Chelsea.
Yeah.
Had a lifelong connection with them, and Southend of United, of course. But how has your relationship with Chelsea changed over the years? You know, you used to go and...
It was, you know, my dad and my granddad supported Chelsea, even though I grew up in Southend. And used to go and see Southend United on a Friday night. On a Saturday, we'd go up and see Chelsea or... Actually, other London clubs at times, but it's always been Chelsea. They were always, it was bred in me to support them, but I always felt a real link with them because they were never quite successful, you know, never quite achieving. You know, they were kind of, they were quite fancy dans at one stage, you know, they got relegated twice in my lifetime, you know, they've come back up, you know, so it's always been lots of hope, you know. In the 90s, finally got to cup final, which is great, lost 4-0 to Man United, which was typical of what you expected from Chelsea. You know, it's always a lot of hope, always a lot of fun. All changed really when they were taken over by the Russian, you know, and the very hope that you'd have when you walk to a game gone. It's all anticipation now. So I used to have a season ticket. I gave it up back about 10 years ago now. When I think penultimate game of the season, at home we played Man United. We'd beaten 3-0 a couple of years previously. That would have been wonderful. We would have said, we've beaten United 3-0. Let's all go and have a drink and celebrate. But we all left the ground thinking, we should have done better. You know, we're better than this now. And so the joy, an awful lot of the joy was gone. You know, we weren't the sort of eternal hopers, optimists, occasional cup win. It was suddenly we're expecting to win everything, you know. And obviously it's nice to win things, win in the leagues and cups and European cups. But the childlike joy is gone now. You know, moved on to a different thing. If I had the choice, I'd love to support someone else. Someone maybe in the Championship, whatever. You know, just so that you can capture that joy of getting promotion, joy of reaching a cup final. You know, I've now seen Chelsea in I don't know how many cup finals, 17 cup finals at Wembley, at Chelsea, abroad, and you know I can't remember them now. I could tell you. Every single round of the cup in 94, in 97. In 97, we went to every round, home and away, Portsmouth and Leicester. It was exciting. Now, I can't tell you the last cup final I went to, really, and who we beat, you know.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't wish you Sheffield Wednesday. And can you remember a moment of either pure elation or pure fear as well? Because, you know, sporting football...
The elation, you know, I can remember the... 97 cup final when Bobby Di Matteo scored after 43 seconds. You know, and it's the second cup final I've been to with Chelsea, and you know you finally thought, right, actually we might actually win something, we might actually do it, and the you know that joy when we scored so quickly, and then the fear for roughly about 70 minutes, you know, and I thought they might equalise, and then Eddie Newton got second and it was all over, and we won. You know, we celebrated at Wembley that day for about an hour afterwards. We didn't leave the ground, and neither did the players. It was just such a joy, such a release of emotion, such a feeling that all those years, I mean, I was 35, I don't know, it was a long years ago anyway, but, you know, I thought I'd spent my whole life supporting Chelsea and finally I've got some reward. What the second part of your question was?
I was saying, is there ever a moment where you felt intimidated or scared, you know, when you've been supporting them, you know, during the 80s?
Oh, God, yeah, in the 70s and 80s, it was, and right through to the 90s. The last time I remember was 95, played Millwall in the Cup. There were 2-2 away at the Den, at New Den it was, actually. We were kept in the ground for about 45 minutes afterwards, and then all funneled up away from the Millwall fans, and they were chanting at the end of the road. When they came back to Chelsea a couple of weeks later, it went to extra time. They got a goal. They invaded the pitch, you know, and their idea of invading the pitch wasn't celebrate. It was to run over and try and smack us one, you know. As a consequence of them, when the final whistle went, lots of our fans invaded the pitch to try and get the Millwall fans. That basic innate violence was still there, and it's frightening. I've always wanted to... You know, to run away from it, to be honest. I don't want to get hurt. More recently, I've experienced it a bit at Spurs, away at Spurs, you know. But, you know, largely, touch wood, it's gone, those kind of days.
So what's your third choice?
Third choice is a tune by Hugh Brown, reggae toaster from the 70s. It's called Black Star Liner. And I counted it on the John Peel show. Really, you know, for most people my age, John Peel was a massive influence.
Of course, yeah.
You know, and he moved on from playing his hoary old rockers onto punk and stuff, and then reggae and dub reggae. This is particular one was a 12-inch version of this, which, you know, introduced me. I had heard dub reggae, and in fact, I had one or two singles, but this just seemed, you know, next to, I don't know, Sham 69, then U Brown and something else, just opened my eyes to the idea that all music can be good, you know. Mm. And I've had a lifelong love of reggae before then, but since then as well, you know, particularly the dub, particularly the root stuff, going back to ska and everything else. But it was Peely that made me think about, I don't have to, you know, I define myself almost until then to think, right, I'm a punk rocker now, you know, so anything else is rubbish, you know. And then, well, actually, reggae's all right. And then once you think that reggae's all right, well, actually, a lot of this sort of funk is all right as well, because it's quite similar music and ska. And then jazz, and why not? And then everything's okay, you know. Mm. Still lots of things I don't particularly favour, but what I believe now, all music is good. All music is designed to make people feel happy and enjoy themselves.
Stop your fuss and fight, so whether you're black or white, let's get together and we all unite. Make us step it on the black star line. I make us step it on the black star line. And some is saying, I mean, I want no more war and down, yeah. I mean, I want no more war and down, yeah. Yeah, get on. Stop give everyone a life to live. So black people are white, women color, you are, come and live it right now. Make us step it on the black star line. I mean, no one, no more tribal honor. I mean, no one, no more tribal honor. Some say, I make me step it on a black star line. Step it on a black star line. Some say, shove it on a black star line. Love is not a fact, ain't no love is not to boast. For black nation, we the suffer the most. Come make me step it on a black star line. I mean, no one, no more war on down. I mean, no one, no more fussing on down. I mean, no one, no more fighting down.
So, Simon, it's ironic that we're sort of digging into your music collection, because you actually had a sizable music collection that you just got rid of.
Yeah, it's quite astonishing
for a music collecting nerd like I.
I had about 5,000 albums, something like 7,000 to 8,000 singles and 12 inches that I built up. Mm. You know, my first record I bought when I was 9, I think.
Yeah,
I can remember where I bought it. It's Swansea Boots. Mm. We used to go down to Wales every holiday. My mum's Welsh, and the Swansea Boots, and they used to sell old singles for 10p. Mm. And that summer, we'd been to Austria on a school trip because the dad was a teacher, and one of the tracks that the boys kept on playing on the jukebox was John Lennon's "Power to the People."
Mm.
You know, so we came back from Austria and then went down to Wales as we normally did, and I sold the single for 10p. In Swansea's Boots, so I thought I'd buy it, you know. Picture cover, John Lennon picture cover, you know. And that ownership, actually owning vinyl, was great. The excitement, I remember, you know, then getting more singles and getting little singles. I think my sister went to Germany and brought me back a little singles bag box that could hold 20 singles. Oh, great, I must fill this up with 20 singles, you know. And then pretty soon I had 100 singles and a few albums, and you know, then it went on and on and on. I wanted to acquire everything I liked, you know, so that I could play everything. But, you know, compact discs came in, I stopped playing the vinyl, CDs are much easier to use. Mm. So they ended up in a room in my flat, and when my wife moved in, well, we had to get rid of them all. So, you know, I had to let go.
How much of a wrench was that, was it?
I couldn't have contemplated it, but it really was. We haven't got the room for them, you know, so...
You weren't tempted to replace your mattress with them, you know.
So, no, they went, and I, you know, there were some records I loved. I would quite like to have them now, but...
Tear in your eye, Sam. So what format have you got the next tune on?
You know, MP3s all over the place now. I've still got, to be honest, I've still got about 5,000 CDs, you know, so...
But what format have you got this next tune in?
Next tune is Lullaby of Birdland by Sarah Vaughan. And it goes back to the previous tune that I was talking about, Peely opened my eyes to different music. So in the early 80s, you know, suddenly jazz seemed okay. And I remember there was a collection called Jazz Juice, which came out on the Street Sounds label. And it was all sorts of funky stuff, and it included Lullaby of Birdland by this woman, Sarah Vaughan. And I thought, oh, this is great. And we used to dance to it at different clubs of the time, of the early 80s. And she was on at the Royal Albert Hall, so I thought, oh, I'll go and see her, you know. And I suppose in my mind I expected to see lots of what then were hipsters, you know, filling it. But they weren't. There were some, of course. Mm. But I remember I sat next to this bloke who's about 80, you know, and he said, oh, yeah, I first saw her in 1951 or something, you know.
Yeah.
And again, that was another awareness of the fact that the music you like doesn't have to be the latest music, doesn't have to be something that's just come out. You can go right back to the, you know, decades before and find some great tunes, you know. Mm. I mean, with kids today, they've got rid of all those, you know, they're not bound by the charts so much, they're bound by the stuff they like, you know.
Yeah.
That's what MP3s released us from that, if you like, tyranny. But back then it was very much, oh, this is what's cool is what's new, you know.
Yeah.
So listening to someone like Sarah Vaughan and seeing her live and realising that actually all music, going right back, can be just as irrelevant today as it was back then.
Let's take a trip back then.
Lullaby of Birdland, that's what I always hear when you sigh. Never in my word land could there be ways to reveal in a phrase how I feel. Have you ever heard two turtle doves, bill and coo, when they love? That's the kind of magic music we make with our lips when we kiss. And there's a weepy old willow, he really knows how to cry. That's how I'd cry on my pillow if you should tell me farewell and goodbye. Lullaby of Birdland, whisper low, kiss me sweet and we'll go flying high in Birdland, high in the sky up above, all because we're in love.
That was Sarah Vaughan. So, Simon, as I mentioned, you are the people's champion. That's how people know you in the Independent. You're the money editor. How do you approach trying to sort of delve into people's lives and help them? You know, you seem to find that quite rewarding.
I do find it rewarding, you know. It's not... basic journalism, when you're reporting on something, is, you know, you're informing people stuff. I get a real thrill out of being able to help people, you know. And when it comes to finance, a lot of people can't help themselves because they find it confusing, they find it difficult to engage with it because it's complicated, or they just get banjacked by the whole principle of it, you know. And there are so many people who are treated unfairly by big companies. It really is a Goliath and a kind of story, you know. So it's, you know, you can tell from talking to people genuinely that they are confused.
Mm.
And sometimes it's quite simple to help them. You know, so, you know, I encourage people to write to me and talk to them. Even talk to people in pub, I often get stories from them, because everyone's got a tale of how their bank or their energy company or their mobile phone company has ripped them off. And mostly it's they've been badly treated, you know.
Yeah.
And the more I can highlight it, the more I can force these companies to behave well, that pleases me. Mm. But the fact is, if I can help one person, you know, if I write a story that says, oh, watch out for this, and someone writes me and says, oh, I didn't know that,
yeah,
you know, I think that's been worthwhile.
Yeah.
It's not, I'm not just filling space, I'm actually helping people, you know.
Absolutely. And you've worked in most of the newsrooms on Fleet Street over the last...
I've worked at the Guardian, the Mirror, the Express, shifted at the Mail, you know, the...
What are the atmospheres like in it? You know, from the outside world, people see working in newspapers quite as prestigious, but very dog eat dog. What's your experience?
Yeah, in the it varies around. And my experience is that they're not particularly nice places. You know, they're not. There can be a lot of competition. There can be a lot of bullying.
Mm.
Still, you know, particularly on some of the tabloids. You know, and the bullying comes out of a need to get all the stories done, but it manifests itself often in unpleasant ways. And I find that the Independent, when I joined there was a much more collegiate spirit, everyone was happy to help, much more, a much friendlier paper, much leaner workforce, perhaps, so that there wasn't, you know, if anyone did try to bully anyone,
well,
the works won't get done, because, you know, it's not, I don't find it productive ways.
Yeah.
You know, it's a carrot rather than stick, and so it's been a joy working... at the Indy, where there have been many more helpful people.
That's good. And one of the reasons that you're so well liked, I think, is that you don't take yourself too seriously, as you say. And, you know, you've got a sort of childlike attitude. I mean, I think one time you even played cricket in the office.
One place I worked, we, you know, used to work on Saturday or Sunday sometimes. So when there's no one else around, we take advantage of a quiet downtimes, played cricket in one office. You know,
between
between features. You know, there was a big, in one office, there was a big globe, which served as a football until we burst it, which we all denied, of course. You know, the cricket, you can always have a game of cricket with rolled up paper with various rulers as bats, you know, and they all help to pass the time. You know, particularly if you're working at the weekend and you feel a bit fed up, half an hour doing this is a good way to let off a bit of steam. I haven't done that for years, to be honest, though.
No, of course not. You're far too sensible. So tell us about your next tune. Is that one to let off steam as well?
No, it's not. It's Next is Next. Next is the Scott Walker version of the Jacques Brel song, Au Suivant. It's, Jacques Brel I loved, if I could understand his stuff, but, you know, wonderful musician, wonderful teller of tales, wonderful. You know, I do like a song with story. This has got a real story. You know, it's about a soldier whose first experience with a woman. You know, and it has a lot of humour. You know, perhaps a little bit shocking in here at the first time, but it's got a great. I like that kind of the beat of it. I wouldn't say it's one of my favourite songs, but it's fun and interesting song. You know, it shows that pop music, which Jacques Brel was just a pop musician, really, doesn't have to be just I love you and you love me. It can be, it can tell a tale, it can have some interesting word choices, and this is a translation of the original Belgium, of course, but, you know, it's still, and Scott Walker I loved, you know, in the music world, he's always pushed the boundaries a bit and things, and some of his more recent things are quite impenetrable. I'd recommend them if you've got the time, but you know, you might find them a bit impenetrable. But if you go back to the 60s and Jacques Brel covers and some of his own works, they're just masterful pop creations.
I really would have liked a little touch of tenderness, maybe a word, just a smile, some instant happiness, but no, next. Oh, it wasn't so tragic. The high heavens didn't fall, but how much at that time I hated being there at all. Next. Now I always will recall the brothel truck, the flying flags, the queer lieutenant who slapped our asses as if we were fags. Next, you're next. I swear on the wet head of my first case of gonorrhea, it's his ugly voice that I forever hear. Next, that voice that stinks of corpses, of whiskey and of mud. It is the voice of nations, that thick voice of blood. Next. And since then, each woman I've taken to bed seems to laugh in my arms and
So, Mr. Reed, we were talking about your sort of childlike attitude to some things, but how have you approached fatherhood? You've got two boys.
I mean, to be honest, it's the first time having children, the first time in my life, you know, you have responsibilities that you don't want to avoid. You want to embrace it. You know, it's a huge, great privilege to be a parent. You know, it's a huge, great challenge. It brings its joys and its pains, you know. It's like all things in life. You know, you can't have joys without pains. You've got to have a balance. If you try and stay away from experiencing things, then it can be a little bit dull. Parenting's not dull. It's funny, when we started, you know, my son was little, I couldn't wait to get home to see him and, you know, change his nappy, whatever it might have been. Whereas I had friends who were finishing work and then, just going for a couple of pints, you know, so that they could avoid all the domestic stuff or spending time with the child, you know, and, I won't get home too late because by that time he or she would be in bed. It just seemed such a bizarre thing to want to miss out on these golden times, you know. I mean, not, you know, lots of people don't want to be parents, which is fine, but I enjoyed it all. I mean, as I say, there are some bad times, but it's great, and it's It's great when you have these. I've got two boys, and they're lovely boys, and they're growing up 12, 15 now, and they're respectful, and they're growing up to be nice people. Yeah. Mm.
And what part does music play with the boys and with that?
I've always played music at home. I always like to have a musical home. It suggests a home full of joy rather than hate or whatever. I don't know, but I've always played a lot of music to them. They've always been aware of different things. They listen to music. I get from them, they don't have the same passion as I do, but I don't know if youngsters have the same passion. When I was growing up, we didn't have the computer games, which takes up a lot more of their time. Yeah. Although I'd play stuff to my son. He says, "Oh, that was in FIFA 14." So they're kind of enjoying music in a different way. And who knows what will happen in the future? Is all good stuff.
Yeah, of course. And Abby, how do you share music with her?
Well, I play a lot of stuff to her. She likes a lot of the same music. Well, she likes a lot of music. I've realised she doesn't like anything that is like post-rock or drone or anything like that. I discovered this, actually, it's not recently, I discovered this back in the early 90s. We've been together a long time. Mm. And with a group who, Sonic Youth, they were, I can't remember what category you'd describe them, but they're sort of post-rock, I suppose.
Yeah.
And I played, I remember I went to the States and I picked up their latest album at the time. It's the first on a major label, I forgot what it's called.
Daydream Nation, probably.
No, it wasn't. It was one after Daydream Nation. Goo. Was it Goo? Anyway, so I played her that. I'd say, "Oh, this is great. I've been really enjoying this." And she'd "It's awful. It's just awful noise, So I didn't play it to her for about 20 years. And then we had some friends over and I made a playlist. I thought, "Well, I'll stick a Sonic Youth track."
Right.
And within about 3 seconds of it coming on, she's, "Oh, what's this? It's terrible." So she doesn't like that kind of stuff,
At least she's consistent.
She's very consistent, and I try and throw some into the mix now and again, and she, her face curls up.
So are your next choice past the Abbey test?
Yes, up to a point. Hmm. Up to a point. It's Fela Kuti. Fela Kuti, okay. I think, is, music. I like music that makes you dance is fantastic. Hmm. Music that makes you feel happy is fantastic. A number of times I've been, I don't know, wherever it might be, and you just hear the opening tracks of a Fela Kuti track. Hmm. It starts off normally quite quiet, just a little couple notes, and you think, "Oh, yeah," and if you listen to it, it just builds up and builds up, and the excitement builds up, and it might be 10 minutes before the chorus starts, and it's just, you're just right there, but it's not just the funk, the post-James Brown funk that he creates that's exciting. It's the words, slightly pidgin English at times, because he's from Nigeria, but very political. I like political songs. Again, it's pop music doesn't need to be trite. It can carry important messages.
Yeah.
The track I've chosen is not the most deep of them, but it also demonstrates the sense of humour that you had. The song I've chosen is called Expensive Shit. And there's just a famous story where the police were always trying to arrest him for different crimes. They planted some dope on him at one time, so he swallowed it. So it took him down the police station, waited for his shit to come out so that they could analyse it and then do him. He was so popular over there.
Yeah.
Apparently, so the story goes, other cellmates gave him their shit to use, and so there was no proof, and they had to let him go, And he wrote the song, Expensive Shit, that he was in the station for 24 hours. All the police had come to his compound to arrest him and look after him. It cost him a lot of money for nothing, and the song's all about that. It's really funky. Even without the lyrics, it's a really fun 15 minutes. You listen to the lyrics and he's really having a go at the police, which are largely... the police deserve to be had a go at, but in such a funny and interesting way and based on a true story. It's got lots going on.
Excellent. Well, we may have to truncate it slightly, but let's have a listen.
Me, I be fella, I be black power man. Me, I be fella, I be black power man. I go bend my ass, I go shit. I go come out away from this shit. This shit could be the last way I go like to see. Not be so for some fools way I know. Not be so for some stupid people I know. Not be so for some fools way I know. People where go like to quench your soul. People where go like to quench your soul.
I
can use that shit to put you for jail.
I
can't turn my shit to expensive shit. That shit na exhibit, he must not lose you.
I
can't turn my shit to expensive shit. My shit na exhibit, he must not lose you.
That was Fela Kuti. So, Simon, can you tell us, you seem like quite a day-to-day, you know, what am I going to do today kind of person, but what do you think about the future? Are you one of those journalists who's desperate to, you know, pen a book? In fact, you have been published.
I have been published in books. No, ambition is not... I'd love to be able to write a book, but I haven't got the patience or the ability, to be honest. I mean, I'm happy just to go on day to day. You know, I like helping people. I like the work I do. Mm. Like most people, I do more money, but that's sure. I feel very blessed to have work that I enjoy. You know, you think of millions of people in jobs that they hate, and they don't feel they can escape. So in that sense, I'm fine. The future, I'm not one to look to the future. I can take care of himself. You know. Mm. I've never particularly had plans in my life, which, you know, can be annoying for the people around me sometimes, but, the future is important, but the now is more important. You know, it's that thing about making sure that you do have a good time, not all the time, but, you know, when you can. You know, you don't want to have a life of drudgery, you want to have a life of... that you look back and think, that was good fun, I enjoyed it.
And you'll be there sipping cocktails forever.
Definitely.
What's your favourite?
Favorite cocktail? Mm-hmm. It comes and goes, you know, like Manhattan or a sidecar or a...
Sidecars, you're synonymous.
Yeah,
Sidecar Reader, shouldn't I?
Drink a lot of sidecars, yeah.
So what's your next choice, your seventh?
I was going to talk about Nick Cave.
Fantastic.
Okay, he was, you know, birthday party and onwards to the 80s. I saw him in the 80s. And then, you know, when I was about 30, I can remember going to some gigs. I saw someone like Carter USM. It's early 90s, Carter USM. Who else did I see that? And I looked around the audience. I thought, I'm too old for this. I've got to stop going to live music. Sorry, young people, you know. And I didn't go to a gig for at least 2 years, maybe 3 years. And then someone said, oh, Nick Cave's at the Royal Albert Hall. You know, you want to come along? I thought, oh, why not? You know, and I went to see him. And it all came rushing back, the joy of hearing songs that you know. And particularly with him, I really noticed that I've always liked all his music, but on album it's okay, it's nice, but live, it's suddenly it's much better. It really, really hits home. I find him a great performer.
Yeah.
You know, he knows how to. I mean, it looks like he's having fun. Yeah. Some of the subject matter is quite serious, but you know, he doesn't seem to take himself too seriously. So every gig I've been to, I've enjoyed. It's it really introduced me to the joy of going to live concerts, and I haven't stopped going ever since. I mean, try and do at least 10 or 12 every year, you know, different things. And, you know, small, and he did. But, in fact, the song I've chosen is not his version.
Mm.
It's one of my most favourite songs of his. But the version I like best is by Johnny Cash. The song is called The Mercy Seat, you know, about someone facing the electric chair.
Yeah.
And Johnny Cash's version, you know, he did those great series of albums when he's approaching his death. Gravitas, you know, they're just fantastic versions.
It's made of wood and wire, and my body is on fire, and God is never far away. Into the mercy seat I climb, my head is shaved, my head is wired, and like a moth that tries to enter the bright eye, I go shuffling out of life just to hide in death a while. And anyway, I never lie. And the mercy seat is waiting, and I think my head is burning, and in a way I'm yearning to be done with all this weighing of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and anyway I told the truth, and I'm not afraid to die. And the mercy seat is burning, and I think my head is glowing, and in a way I'm hoping to be done with all this twisting of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and anyway there was no proof, and I'm not afraid to die.
So Simon, we've cast you out into the desert with these 8 tunes. How resourceful are you? How would you find yourself in the desert? You're quite a people person, but I'm sure you could amuse yourself.
I could. I mean, I do like people. I do like talking to people, spending time with people, but, you know, I'm equally happy amusing myself, particularly with music. And, you know, it can transport you into wherever you want, you know. So I'd keep myself company fairly well. As long as I'm allowed a luxury item, aren't I?
Yes, you are. What would you select?
Well, my luxury item would be a cocktail shaker, on the assumption that there'd be regular bottles of booze appearing, you know, floating down from sky or whatever, you know, so that I can keep myself busy, you know, creating new cocktails, just creating some of my favourites, you know, and whiling away a few hours, having a few drinks, listening to music, singing to myself, you know, this kind of thing, you know. Dancing to myself, you know.
Yeah, fantastic. And, you know, we're actually quite generous here on Desert Isolation Gist, so we give you that and the Tiger Who Came to Tea and the Red Dwarf box set. So you will be sorted. So, Simon, what's your final choice of today?
Well, the final song, really, is... It sort of sums up my philosophy of life, really. It's a song, Lieber and Stoller song from the 60s, called Is That All There Is? And a version that I like by Peggy Lee... you know, if it's you know, it's about an old cynic, really, who says, "Never mind, you know, we're all going to die one day, but in the meantime, let's keep drinking and dancing."
And when I was 12 years old, my daddy took me to the circus, the greatest show on earth. There were clowns and elephants and dancing bears, and a beautiful lady in pink tights flew high above our heads. And as I sat there watching, I had the feeling that something was missing. I don't know what, but when it was all over, I said to myself, "Is that all there is to the circus? Is that all there is? Is that all there is? If that's all there is, my friend, then let's keep dancing. Let's break out the booze and have a ball. If that's all there is."
So, Simon, that's your eight choices. If you had to just pick one of those to live forevermore with, what would it be?
That's a very difficult one, isn't it? It would have to be one that I would be happy singing and dancing to for the rest of my life. Gosh, that's very hard. Do you know what? I'd probably just go for Peggy Lee there and, you know, break out the booze and have a ball, sit there in my solitude, making my cocktails. Yeah.
He paints an image of you. It's a hard one to shake. Simon Reed, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you as my guest on Desert Isolation Disc.
Yeah, well, thank you for inviting me. Enjoyed it.
Hey, oh, let's go. Hey, oh, let's go. Hey, oh, let's go. Hey, oh, let's go.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.